Thanks, Bob. I was just wondering whether a few people have come by going probably go to the Pan Continental meeting next door. They've opened the door, they've seen us having a meeting in here with all the money. I wonder what they're really thinking. As Bob and Greg did, I'd gathered some files on the cost of government and the cost of tax, and I guess we just really don't need these. But there's one thing that's relevant. There's a quote here from, once again, from Hugh Morgan, where he points out the cost of each politician, the cost of the taxpayers, is $250,000 per year to feed each politician. Now that's okay. It's just a statistic. But I mentioned here, and I mentioned Graham Campbell. If Graham Campbell can turn the federal government around on their proposed gold tax, then I think maybe that $250,000 is the best investment this area's ever made. So I certainly wish him well, and Graham's actually offered to give me lots of examples of government waste that really rile him. And from quite a few discussions I've had with Graham, I'd say he's probably the best federal member that the Goldfields have ever had. So I certainly wish him well, because he's putting our case very well and very strongly to Canberra. There's another file of reasons why the tax summit won't help, why the consumer tax will be a disaster. Another one called "What Can We Do?" If we got 10 minutes, do you think, for a little bit of what we can do? Is that fine? Okay, we'll tighten it up a bit, okay? I think it's obvious that nobody's going to save us but ourselves in this terrible situation we've got. And I've got, I think, three or four points to make. One is that, number one, we should educate ourselves. And that, I don't mean books produced by government departments, and most of you in business, most of the books on how to run a business seem to be printed by the government these days, or the Small Business Development Corporation, or some of these other government departments. Well, we should learn how to protect ourselves from books that are produced by people on our side of the fence, not on the enemy's side. So if you want some advice on what to read, there's bundles of books like these. There's a monthly magazine being produced called Optimism, and it's full of the good news. And there's a lot of it around. It doesn't make its way into the newspapers. There's a lot of good stuff in that one. And there's some free copies here for anyone to grab and take away tonight. I think we should educate ourselves to the point where we can explain to politicians and our political representatives at whenever we meet them, whenever we talk to them, explain to them that we insist that they bring about a reversal of the current mess. Remind them that the Keynesian Marxist economic theories that many of them have been following have been thoroughly discredited in so many countries, leaving the people there impoverished and in many cases actually starving. You know, these are the same economic theories that they're dabbling with in these white papers. It's incredible. We should show them how history has always demonstrated that regardless of short-term benefits, in the long term, government intervention into private peaceful activity in the economy of the country tends to make things worse rather than better every time. And there's a book I've got for 4,000 years of examples where they've collected these instances. Let them know at all times that we are aware that the only lasting way to increase the standard of living of people is to increase the amount of capital invested per capita, and that the proper political and economic strategy would be a program of drastic tax reductions. Firstly, we must have tax reductions with investment tax credits to increase the investment, with the total absence of capital gains taxes, and this would shortly be followed by a drastic reduction in government expenditure. When they tell you about all the unemployment that will be created by a reduction in government expenditure, we should be educated enough to tell them that the stimulus provided to the private sector by these actions will in turn compensate more than necessary for any momentary increase in the government deficit, even if they took the predictable step on being a few months late with some of the reductions. And they found that they were still running on with this high expenditure gap. The momentum would be such, and the tax base would be broadened by all of us earning more, all of us paying more, that we'd pick up that shortfall in the deficit without any trouble at all. These are things they can't argue with. These other countries are doing this. Other countries are steering toward this privatisation. There's some classic examples in here of Margaret Thatcher's government and this Dr. Madsen Peary that people associated with me brought to Australia and carted him all around to every state. How they're dismembering things like the State Housing Commission, how they're dismembering in England Telecom. They're selling it off to shares in the public. They've sold off, selling off British Steel. And these things are very successful. They're doing it in such a way that there's no dislocation for people. And that's really a professional approach. And that's I draw attention to that one there. The point, I think, not generally realised by either Liberal or Labor parties, unfortunately, is the importance of increasing the reward for working, investing and producing. Cutting taxes that don't increase the reward or change economic behaviour is really no tax cut that's going to have any effect on the productive sector of the economy. It would seem that the politicians and bureaucrats are probably short on realism, probably because they're busy, probably because they're reading all the papers and all that stuff. There's a reason for them being busy, but they don't appear to grasp the fact that if you reduce the after-tax reward for something, you get less of it. And if you increase the subsidy of something, you get more of it. And I think that's today. In Australia, we are taxing work, we're taxing savings, investment, thrift, productivity, effort, success and risk, and we're subsidising all these other things like non-work, unemployment, debt, borrowing, consumption, leisure, idleness and mediocrity, and we're getting so much more of the latter than we're getting of the former. And there's no mystery to all this, but if we're able to tell these politicians to the point where they're almost not brave enough to go on the streets unless they're fully armed to sort of come up with some answers of what they're actually doing to change it. It all sounds very simple, I guess, but unless enough of us are equipped with this knowledge, this crippling effect of government intervention will go on. But if there's enough of us, the politicians might take steps to limit government activity to its correct role of referee and protector of individuals' rights and their property. That's necessary. It's slow, but it's necessary, and the encouraging thing that it's certainly happening in the US and it's certainly happening in England. And certainly no reason why it can't happen here, because there's enough people now being turned on about this. There's a big economic conference in Sydney called the Montpelerin Society meeting next month that is going to stimulate a lot of the stuff, and I think Madsen Peary's coming back for that. The number two way we can change this thing around is to cease to be part of the problem and become part of the solution instead. Now, I'll just be terribly brief on this one because I'd love a motion to come out of here to this effect. Now, every major segment of Australia is sort of gaining benefits from government expenditure, and if we, and I, you know, we look mainly to be business people here, so I can speak in that broad term, if we as business people start saying, trim the Aboriginal budget, trim the unemployment, trim everything else, you know, that's just us knocking some other bloke, but we want to be left alone. I think we've got to set the pattern and set the example and say, hey, we're all receiving benefits, we must be the key, and we as business people must say, look at all these subsidies we're getting. Look at all these organisations doing all this work for us, the XM Bank in Perth, and the WA Development Corporation, the West Australia Small Business Development. Put them all together, they're just on the state level. Multiply that again by the federal level. Put them all together, and that's hundreds of millions of dollars that we are collecting as subsidy. So we really lose so much credibility, especially with the younger people, when we stand up and talk about the free enterprise system. We really lack a credibility, but I think if we take this step, and I'd be happy to organise a resolution from tonight's meeting that we could come out this meeting to fire a cannon into the Chambers of Commerce and all of the other federated industry organisations that we're involved with to say, what about us taking this step and see where we go from there? And I think once we've done that, then a few of us can throw down the gauntlet to the other pressure groups like the farmers' organisations, the labour unions, and then we can put Canberra on this long-needed diet. There's a third one, and I'll... How are we going? You still with it?
Right.
Okay. Well, I think the meeting hasn't started next door there. It's a formal dinner, so we'll sort of I'll watch them. The other third step is massive, peaceful, civil disobedience from the business sector. And it's one that we don't need to be a member of anything. We can just do it ourselves. And I've been doing it for years, and I love it. You know, and it's just such good fun, and it doesn't cost very much money either to do. And I think, you know, on this case with this white paper, we should get up off our knees and make sure that we as business people say, well, they can have their consumption tax if they like, but we're not going to collect it for them. And it'll make us our job easier if we can get some of the big organisations on side to tell them the same thing. it's just a matter of injecting some backbone into some of these employer organisations who are pretty getting to the stage of being pretty all switched on. If they exhibited some unity and they sort of started with the consumer tax and said, well, we won't collect that, and then we could move on and say, well, the government, dear government, please make your own arrangements on the group tax, the payroll tax, the sales tax and the prescribed payments tax too. You know, they have all these taxes if they like, but let them do the work as the government. Let's not be the middleman dipping our fingers into people's pay packets and passing it on to some other bloke as we're doing now. But I think until that happens, and it's not impossible for that to happen, but until that happens, let's see how the unions handle it. The thought was in this tax summit was that they're going to tax fringe benefits. The first thing was that the union said, you're not going to tax us on fringe benefits. The government said, oh well, we can't go that way, so they're going to tax the business people. The business people haven't murmured. They're just going to remit the tax on fringe benefits, company cars, company houses on. There hasn't been a murmur, and I find that appalling. And Bob, you're right, plugged into the organisations we're talking about. We can make some mention there. But anyway, meanwhile, we can exhibit some non-compliant behaviour just perhaps as individuals. And there's a couple of examples here that I think it's important never to cooperate with any of these, whether it be a tax inspector or a bureaucracy guy or anyone that comes to have a look at them, because you can't really logically be expected to assist a thief if he comes to your house. You really must make his job as difficult as you possibly can. If you're investigated and you receive one of these dreadful, long, departmental, itemised questionnaires, delay the reply as long as you can. Then when they run out of patience, we've got plenty of patience, but when they run out of it, ask for a copy of their original letter as you appear to have mislaid it. When you reply with very exact answers, give the wrong reference numbers and file numbers. It could be that they'll be unable to match up all this information and they'll be too embarrassed to proceed with the matter any further. Eventually they may write asking for more detailed answers in the hope that this will give them clues to the original questions, enabling them to trace the reference numbers that you quoted. But when you reply this time, quoting the correct reference numbers, you should give exact answers, but to entirely different questions. Fictitious questions. This will start the cycle over again, and you can bombard them with requests for a copy of their original letter, which they never ever wrote. The challenge is to keep this sort of thing going on for as long as possible, perhaps 10 years or so, as it's good therapy for their staff. A lot of people I know, when replying to the tax department, stick the stamp in the top left corner of the envelope or sometimes in the centre. I've never bothered to put a stamp on them. Any of correspondence there, and they always pay the surplus, or they always it never comes back, and they're always going to pay and get it because they live in high hopes that there's some money in the envelopes. If you ever find yourself in the position of having to send them money, always send the wrong amount, and always staple your cheque in the centre of the form. It serves to jam up their electronic receipting devices. Rub candle grease in the space marked for official use only. I know, if you're short of candle grease, use hair oil. Love it. When you're investigated, among the first things they do is run to your bank, and without your knowledge, this is the important thing, without your knowledge, they photocopy all your bank records, all your cancelled checks and all. So it may be best to have your bank checks printed, as you can have these days, on dark red paper. Then it's almost impossible to distinguish the dark red paper from the ink when they do the photocopies. There's also a particularly fine pen that I can tell you where you can get them from. They're called Commercial Light Blue Illustrator Non-Reproducing Pen. It's very thin. It will not reproduce on microfilm copies or photocopies. So they could do all those copies and find there's nothing on them. The object of their investigations is linked to the taxman having to generate a certain dollar volume for each hour of work. And it's possible that if you can run up their time, they may wish to avoid you entirely. With a bit of luck, they may even take you off their mailing list too. Actually, a surefire way of upsetting them seems to be to include some unspecified sundry income on your tax return, even if it's only for a few hundred dollars. They go paranoid. They keep insisting that you inform them where this unspecified income came from. And you just have to explain to them that you must be honest, otherwise you wouldn't have declared it. It's really the undeclared income that they should be worrying about. And the other one here is, when replying to their correspondence or in personal interviews, I think this is most important, always try to establish some good human relationship with your investigator at all times. Apart from asking about his family and his ancestry, make the odd inquiry about just what is he doing with all this money he's ripping off all his fellow Australians. And ask him also, has he ever considered going out and getting a proper job? Keep it all nice and warm. There's lots of other ways of maintaining good relationships with your investigations, and introduce this relaxed element into these dealings, I think, at all times. Greg would probably know more about this subject than I would, but whilst there is some legal ground for tax inspectors to gain access to your records, there's nothing to permit them to remove these records from your premises. I recall that we used to keep our receipts in a large plastic rubbish bin, which we used to stir up with a broomstick at the end of each day when the fellow had left. That was a bit of a game, actually. There's also nothing that says you should give them cups of tea. We're pretty soft about these things, so we used to keep up a steady supply of tea. There's also nothing to say that you must permit them the use of your toilet. Creates the problem earlier, and then, of course, while they're away back at their motel, you stir the old rubbish bin up again. There are many disadvantages, but more advantages of being classified as a contractor. And over the years, we've sold many of these contractors' contract forms to assist people achieving that status. It helps them hold their money longer and at least earn some interest on it, and it also gives them more tax deductions. The real one big disadvantage may be that they could end up paying provisional tax, but that's only a problem if they pay the tax on time. The success of such contract forms really depends on your own particular circumstances, and advice should be obtained from others on this. There are specified legal tests to define what is a contractor and what is a contract and what isn't. And these tests, there's no question you are one or you aren't one. And this is where you should get the proper advice on this. This does remind me of one tax department where they decided to question the validity of prostitutes actually using these contractors' contract forms. Very delicate subject actually with the ladies here, but these girls were using these contract forms so that they, in fact, could break this tax department's automatic access to their cash. So the prostitute, of course, went off to court where the judge, after hearing all the evidence, agreed with the girl's defence that these prostitutes, in fact, complied with the legal description of what is a contractor. The three tests were, could they complete the task without constant supervision from their employer? It was established in court that they could. Test two, did they have control over the standard of workmanship? The court established that the answer was yes. The third test was, did they bring their own tools to the job? The court again agreed they were yes. They were in fact contractors, and the case from the taxation department was thrown out amid some amusement. So I could go on with these examples all night, but they only serve to show that being in business can be entertaining if we approach it with the right mental attitude. And there's probably one final point which covers the survival bit when we're faced with governments with this spending diarrhea. I see governments as a pet monkey we took on once when it was nice and small, like a small kitten. Now it's grown into this raging gorilla with a diarrhea, with this great big hole through which all the money is just falling. Now, I think John Jones and I think Bob Muir had mentioned about putting the government on a diet. This is what many people are doing by joining the underground economy, which is now being graced with more dignified names, such as the unreported economy. Instead of these people conducting business through conventional channels, they live in an alternative world where substantial discounts are given for cash. I don't know very much about this, but I know it's to the stage in Australia where it's becoming very significant. But I know in some countries the unreported economy is said to represent 60% of the total gross domestic product. And in India, for instance, the government is unable to prepare any meaningful national accounts without acknowledging the economic contribution from the unreported economy. Now, once again, if we were faced with a flat rate or a reasonable taxation level, the unreported economy would shrink. But when the productive sector feels under siege, as it is now, it will expand. And this could be the subject of a separate talk by one of the many experts in this field. So on the subject of the unreported economy, as one of the things that could be done, I'll certainly close my little part of the thing, and if I can just refer to a poem on the same subject that I wrote some years ago, that I must have had nothing to do. It's called Taxation and Survival. There we go. Perhaps we are all orchardists at heart. Having prepared the soil, nurtured the vines, patiently tending the trees, watching our fruit slowly ripen, evidencing that our labours were meaningful, suddenly from the dark clouds swoop scavengers to pick the eyes and decimate our fruit. To remain as bystanders would be in neglect of our responsibility. Surely we have but two choices. Shoot the bastards, but perhaps they would quickly be replaced by even more. Instead, let's gather the fruit swiftly and store it out of reach. That way the decision still remains with us of how we should share the products of our labours. A couple of things I'd like to do now I'm the chairman again. Who would have come furthest tonight to attend this meeting?
Dave Mueller.
He's come all the way. Dave, could you step forward? This is a symbolic presentation on behalf of the taxpayers.
Thank you.